Welcome to Not Work, Myth, and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Season 6, Episode 34, Sovereignty Rising with Rima Bonario. As part of our Myth Workers and Culture Makers series, I'm excited to introduce you to Rima Bonario. She reached out to me a few months ago because we're both fascinated and inspired by one particular word, concept, and way of being, and that's sovereignty. Rima has invited me to be part of her Sovereignty Rising Summit, which is designed to offer insight into how to lead, love, and live with queenly grace in chaotic times. This free 3-day online event runs from November 21st to 23rd. I love the premise of this particular online event. It is meant to offer a path for sensitive, powerful women seeking to stay soft in a hard world. Now, Rima and I have talked a couple of times at this point, and I've really been struck by her sense of authenticity, depth, and grace. From what I know of her work and her presence, there's an abiding sense of beauty to Rima. And by that, I don't mean any kind of skin-deep, limited definition that we're often fed on Instagram every day. Instead, I mean a beauty that has roots as well as blossoms, a beauty that celebrates growth and the dance in the light, but also holds space for the challenges and the shadows. Here, before I go on, let me give you Rima's official bio. Dr. Rima Bonario is an author, dream weaver, and soul coach with over 30 years of experience in spiritual and mystical exploration. She helps women reclaim their inner power, divine wisdom, and radiant presence through archetypal embodiment, ritual, and transformational programs. She is the author of The Seven Queendoms, a soul map for embodying sacred feminine sovereignty, and the founder of Bloom Temple Mystery School. Rima guides women into self-trust, soul-sourced prosperity, and embodied leadership. Holding a doctorate in transformational psychology, Rima blends trauma-informed practices, energy work, and the temple art of anointing to offer profound spiritual transformation. Now, I'd have to verify this, but I'm nearly positive that Rima found me through my own 2020 book, The Sovereignty Knot. It's been truly fascinating to return to my past work and feel into all the ways that it's very much still interwoven into what I'm doing now, in very many ways, thanks to Rima's invitation. So before we dive into the conversation I'm about to share, I want to take a minute just to wander through my own history with my own past creation. In part, I'm doing this to clarify my own enduring yet evolving relationship with this concept and word of sovereignty. And I'm doing it as a writing coach who walks the long, winding path with authors who are putting books into the world. I think there's value in reflecting on how our relationship to our past publications endures and evolves over time. Because it's one thing to write a book and put so much into it. It's another to go through all those processes of publishing it. And then it's yet another to be several years away and still be known for those words upon the printed page. It's a relationship that shifts and changes and hopefully still feeds us. Now, I released The Sovereignty Knot back in 2020. And it was and continues to be my own story of reckoning. It's an exploration of the ways I felt my own sense of sovereignty eroding and the ways in which I'd never established a strong sense of sovereignty in the first place. It's not an easy thing in this culture, even with all the freedoms and rights that our foremothers fought for and secured for us. Sovereignty remains a riddle. So devoting myself to writing and publishing that book was an important moment of arrival. It was an extended opportunity to be with the biggest questions that I was holding at that time. How does one develop a fully embodied sense of self and self-agency in this modern world? And how can mythology and the stories of the ancestors help us now? If you're a longtime listener, you'll understand that I'm still dancing with these questions. So in the first pages of the book, I define sovereignty as your inviolable right to physical, emotional, and spiritual freedom. And then throughout the rest of the pages of the book, I keep exploring how to experience that sort of personal connection and liberation while living inside the larger contexts of partnership, family, community, society. As I think I say during my conversation with Rima, and as I know I've said many times before, ultimately, my book is really about how to navigate the knot, the interconnections and entanglements that come up for any individual who's trying to determine how to be in right relationship with themselves and with the collective. And I love the sovereignty knot, and I'm so damn proud of that woman who had two little kids and was coming through some really challenging personal and professional years, who had really lost her voice in an effort to build a business and fit in with a certain crowd. I got that book out the year I turned 40, and it was immensely important to me as a woman who was claiming her work and her passions, even as she sought greater comfort and confidence in her roles as mother and partner. And maybe this is true for just about every author, at least those of us who dare to look back and wonder. Because I sometimes look back and wonder about how naive I was, but how bold I was to write a book like that when I still had so much to learn. Now, granted, it was only in writing that book that I could welcome in a new season of life and access new wisdom. So now, looking back and wondering about what that author was really thinking, what the me of 6 or 7 years ago really knew, well, it might all be proof that that sovereignty stuff really works. Because maybe that author was a little bit naive, and maybe she learned so much through the writing and releasing of those pages. But here's the thing, back in 2020, those earliest months of 2020, we all were pretty naive. We hadn't lived through what was coming. We hadn't all been changed by that collective catastrophe, COVID. I was, and still am, fascinated by sovereignty as we receive it in Irish mythology. It is both a supernatural and deeply human force. Sovereignty is the glue that holds together the divine realms, the lands, and the structures of early Irish society. And like Rima and many others, I'm inspired by this concept of sovereignty and how empowering it can be for us now, for individuals, particularly women, who tend to lose ourselves in the care of everyone else. So I mentioned 2020, and yes, that was the year the book came out, but it's also the year that sovereignty took on a lot more cultural weight and nuance. As the pandemic dragged on, the contemporary conversation and many arguments around sovereignty emerged, and those felt totally foreign to my work and my perspective. As I understand sovereignty, it's not just about the rights of the individual, but the individual's right to relationship with the self in service of maintaining a healthy relationship to the greater whole. And so, when the contemporary conversation about sovereignty started to indicate a sense of hyper-individualism that was suggesting that one person was solely responsible for their own health and well-being, and that that health and well-being was meant to be lived out in exclusion of an awareness of the collective or community health concerns, that was not the conversation that I wanted to have. And so I spoke about sovereignty less, and I focused on the knot of it all, the ties that bind us to the land, to other people, to the ancestors, to the stories, to ourselves. So in our conversation, Rima and I talk about the challenges that are inherent in celebrating our understanding of sovereignty in divisive times. I'm grateful that her work, which does focus on self-development and empowerment, is deeply interested in the sovereignty of all beings. And it's about being in conscious relationship with the collective, too. So after this rather lengthy introduction, I want to call in one goddess of sovereignty to help launch the rest of this conversation. It's the Kaliak. Why? Well, because it's Samhain. It's her season. This creature of winter and the dark time of the year is truly the original sovereignty goddess. She's as old as time, as old as the earth, and older. Now, the lore tells us that the Kayak was a giantess who walked the seas before the lands emerged from the waters. She was the one who scattered the stones from her apron to make the mountains and islands, all the way from the wilds of Scotland to the furthest reaches of West Kerry. The Kayak shapes the land, and she serves and guards the land across lifetimes. And she herself was a shapeshifter, the Kayak. Though we tend to imagine her in her elder aspect as the crone, she wasn't always the wizened hag. According to the poetry, she had 7 periods of youth when she was consort to kings, mother to kings, matriarch of entire peoples and races. Now you'll hear Rima speak a bit about her 7 archetypal sovereign queens. And this just might be one of those moments when the oldest traditions braid with modern intuition. And if we slow down and pay attention, we just might see that we are, in fact, playing in a territory that's both timeless and true. So without further ado, I'm grateful to bring you this conversation with Rima Benario in advance of her upcoming summit, Sovereignty Rising, which is coming up November 21st to 23rd. I'll include the link in the show notes. But now, the conversation. Well, I am so excited to welcome Rima to the podcast today. This is one of our culture makers and myth workers conversations because Rima has done so much brilliant work in terms of living the myths, making them come alive, interweaving them with her own work. And what really calls us together today is a passion for a single word, sovereignty. As many of my listeners know, The Sovereignty Knot was a book that I wrote about 5 or 6 years ago. And Rima is very much inhabiting that energy herself right now with a current project, but I think also just with the way that she lives life and sees this great adventure upon this earth. So Rima, welcome. I'm so happy to have you here on the show today.
Thank you so much, Marissa. I'm just delighted to be here and to be in this conversation with you.
Yeah. So, you know, let's start with perhaps the hardest question, but the most elemental one in terms of, you know, what is sovereignty to you? What is it that draws you to this word right now? And of course, it's so much more than a word. It is a way of being.
Mm-hmm. Yes. For me, the most important aspect of sovereignty is this idea of being free from undue influence. Mm-hmm. And it comes back to this place of actually deeply knowing oneself. And that, for me, has been a lifelong journey. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of reasons why that's been so, and almost a healing journey, really, in getting out of this way of understanding myself through other people mm-hmm. and through the way others saw me. Much of my growing up years, I was busily trying to find a place to land inside my family that felt safe and comfortable. And that necessitated a lot of tracking of the big people in my life and their moods and their anger and their upsets so that I could try to upregulate that. I've just learned that that's really the technical term for what I was doing. Mm. And then I carried that habit of upregulating the people in my life all throughout my growing up years. And even in my current version of self, I have to catch myself doing that work. And it's part of my superpower. It's part of what makes me good at what I do. You know, I'm as a space holder for women, in a way, tracking others is part of how I serve at the highest level. And in my personal life, it's a hill I have to navigate where I can lose myself inside of the serving, inside of the making safe when especially some of my past trauma is poking its little head up out of the ground.
Upregulating. Wow. You know, we're kind of starting in the psychological weeds, but it's only in the sense of it's the weeds because that's the ground from which we grew up. So I just really appreciate what I think is going to be a conversation which we really weave in. The psychological, the spiritual, the deeply personal, and of course, the very universal, right?
Absolutely. I think when we look at stories of becoming, women's stories of becoming, and the, you know, all the princesses and the Disney world, you know, and I think about how the stories have shifted over the years, we've watched this idea that a good girl, a good maiden, a good young woman, a desirable young woman has that skill, mm-hmm. quote unquote, to upregulate the people in their lives as though that was her obligation, as though that was her responsibility. And then we move into stories of more modern times of Moana, for example. She is not upregulating anybody. She is off doing what she's there to do and expecting people to take care of themselves inside of that picture. And it's not that she's callous or unconcerned. She's totally coming from a place of service. It's just perhaps lacks a bit of that codependent flavor.
Yes. Yes. And wow, that makes so much sense as to if I had to choose a favorite Disney princess, she would be my one, because of course she isn't really a princess. And I bet that's something that's common for many of the listeners here on Knotwork and many folks that you work with as well, because there is that inherently gorgeous sense of having a powerful sense of self in service to the community, in connection with the all.
Right. Right. And that's really the trifecta, right? So mm-hmm. We get shown a very polarized version of what community service relationship looks like. There's either this sort of hyper focused on self version of it where I'm off being the hero and it's a lone experience. And it's really aimed at what my particular needs are. Sometimes irrelevant as to how that affects or impacts those around. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, it's my impact and the way that connection operates is the point, and it's irrelevant how it impacts me. And of course, what true sovereignty is that I read in your gorgeous book and that I speak about in my work is this idea that I think you named it as that I get to have both the romance and the lone wolf sort of sides of myself, right? Where there's I get to have this true self-awareness and core of who I am and my self-identity as an independent, single, valid on its own perspective that then gets to be in authentic relationship with the world and with community. And of course, that is the universal. That is the universal of this experience of life finding itself and differentiating and becoming really unique and full of diversity. And then having these moments of then sort of that being swept away and we come back to the basics again.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you for naming the power of this whole concept, which certainly enamored me. That's why I followed the word and it went so far. And also knowing that sovereignty has become a tricky word in certain ways. And it really has become a very individualistic sort of feeling word term. And just as you're naming it too, you're offering what I see in it is that it's an ancient concept. It comes from our, land-based indigeneity, particularly in my case, it was coming from the stories of Ireland and Celtic Europe. But knowing that sovereignty has always been about interrelationships and has always been about the more than just the one person figuring out their way in the world.
I actually think it's the loss of that realization mm-hmm. that has forced this unnatural polarization upon us that mm-hmm. when we lived embedded in nature and we lived embedded in community in a way that was necessary because of the times or the weather or the need to join labor together, that we understood nobody survived alone. Right. And so inside of that just basic getting it that we need each other, there wasn't sort of this backlash, I don't think. Maybe I'm romanticizing it. Maybe some people did. Our beautiful country, America, which I absolutely love and adore, has a bit of an identity character flaw in that we have leaned into this American individualism as an exceptionalism, as a sort of like, we're so unique and special, we don't need anything. And then we highly value, overvalue the bootstrappy, you know, this was a beautiful thing when we could have success, not based on your bloodline, but based on your own effort, which was critically needed in the world when, mm-hmm. when sovereignty goes bad, right? At the monarch level.
Yes.
And it's just, we're seeing the edges of where that individualism and exceptionalism also begins to fail, you know? So what's the next iteration? And I think you and I naturally began tracking that in our own lives, partly because we're women, and that's been at the crux of how we live in the world, of wanting our own sovereignty and yet knowing we are deeply embedded in our relationships and our family lives.
Yeah. Oh, I so appreciate that kind of the big view, because it's disregarded as, you know, that it's a code for something else. And I often find it comes from men who don't have that same understanding, again, without gendering this completely, but let's be clear that we're speaking in some generalities, that oftentimes it's that need as women to have claimed the self enough to be able to move into that bigger conversation about how we can be part of the all, because one has to find oneself in order to be in that greater relationship. And it doesn't have to then overcorrect back to being, you know, back to solipsism and self-obsession, but it is that sense of, are the basic needs met as an individual in order to then contribute and be part of that bigger fabric?
Right, exactly. And if you think about the founding of this country, that was the exact conversation that was happening there. That was that the merchant class in America was saying, hey, we need to have space in a way where we're not being impinged upon. And the power, whoever has the power that's benefiting from the relationship being unequal, generally doesn't like when someone waves the word sovereignty and says, hey, can we please remember I'm also a sovereign being? Mm-hmm. Because it feels threatening. And then the negotiation has to happen. And that negotiation must continue and will continue, because at the soul level, here's where the universal peace gets to come in. At the soul level, you can't really be anything but sovereign. Mm. And so this journey we go on, this journey of life, is very often just the reckoning of the ways that we're not living our soul's sovereign expression. And when, as those ways become more and more intolerable, we have to put in the work or risk whatever is at stake in order to say yes to our soul.
Mm. And it feels important to name the piece that always complicates this too, as we're looking at both the individual soul level and looking at the national historic level in the settler colonialist situation that made America and made Canada in particular into the countries that they are. It was also based on taking sovereign nations of Indigenous people and signing treaties in bad faith and eventually driving them off this land. And so the fact that this term itself is so fraught and so multi-layered and has, I know even I can speak for myself, I feel at once so held by the word and the concept in a sense of self, and really dislocated at the same time, because it says, how many different layers must I look at? How many different layers are I being invited to look at in order to most fully inhabit my own sense of self, but also what I feel is my responsibility as someone who is awake and aware, deeply privileged, you know, to be living in a beautiful part of the world based on some very dark, difficult histories on all sides, from those who had to cross the ocean, those who were forced to cross the ocean, those who chose to cross the ocean, and those who were here first.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to me, this is where I've landed in my own work, is an exploration of sovereignty as through the lens of the sacred feminine. And mm-hmm. sacred feminine sovereignty for me has a very different multi-layered tone, multi-layered understanding. And as you've described all these horrible things that have happened in the name of, well, I'll get my sovereignty, you deal with your sovereignty is not important. This is what I mean by, when we come into that relationship of recognizing the soul's sovereignty, when we arrive at that place, there is an intrinsic, or it certainly has happened for me, and I've seen it in many ways, it's bubbling up now of this, we can no longer make excuses for I get to be sovereign and you don't. Mm-hmm. Like that whole fallacy has fallen away completely. True sovereignty actually loves, cherishes, wants, and supports the sovereignty of others as well. And that when we're able to come to relationship from that place of a complete and total respect and acknowledgement of the sovereign being across from you, the kinds of agreements, the kinds of negotiations, the kinds of families we create, the kinds of lives we live from the macro to the micro are radically different. And I feel like some of the things that hurt my heart right now when I look out in the world is this disparity I see between some of the progress that's being made on the personal level and in the kitchen tables, as you're saying, and inside a family life that hasn't yet become a big enough wave to affect us in a collective way just yet.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it just speaks to the gorgeous mess of it all. I mean, I landed and eventually I called my book The Sovereignty Knot, but I realized the work for me was in the knot itself and where the weaving is happening and where the tangles are and how we don't lose ourselves in, you know, oh, this is just another intractable problem, right? And then how can we keep re-engaging? And it does come back to seeking out divinity and to seeking out that larger story. And of course, you know, we know we're playing in sandboxes that have cultural appropriation on one side and spiritual bypassing on the other. And there is that inherent danger that I've often, and I'll admit this, I've sometimes just sat out of the conversations, like I just can't debate whether or not I'm walking the right path in between, because we also live in a world where we're supposed to have it exactly right all the time. And it's hard to have conversations like this because they're potentially messy. And yet it comes back to, what do we know at the core level? If we have not only a belief in, but a sense of constantly it being shown to us through our lived experience and the myths we have inherited, the faiths that we've walked through, whether they've injured us or supported us along the way, is that sense of there is something larger than us. There is a divinity woven through this experience in this world.
In my own growth trajectory, going through those periods of time of watching my own spiritual unfolding, I've arrived at a place of no longer demanding that everybody else follow suit. Mm-hmm. No longer believing even that everybody else is here to do the same kind of unfolding. Like for many years, I just thought, well, come on, if everybody just gets on the growth train with me, you know, this is what we need. And I'm gonna keep working and pounding, beating the drum and calling people, because if everybody just gets on this train, we'll get there eventually. And the highest form of my own spiritual development asked me to step into an acceptance that life is this dichotomy, this mm-hmm. dynamic, this messy, beautiful conflict and contrasty place mm-hmm. where some people are on a growth path that's what their soul's here to do, and others are not. And that, like, to remove the lofty spiritual judgment I was holding around that.
Yeah.
And at the same time, be also willing, when the moment asks it of me, just to have boundaries and to have a sense of the holy no along with the sacred yes. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, this thing you named, and I just, if anybody listening needs to hear this today, I hope this really lands in your heart. The way we can be very judgy towards ourselves as we're in that process of coming into that acceptance of noticing we don't always get it right, that it's very hard to, that demand for perfection inside of the spiritual life is in of itself a kind of a sidestep of naming the humanity and divinity that is the point of it all. Mm-hmm. not, again, it's not one or the other. It's that bringing together. And so whether that's, you know, we're trying to find the right language to be respectful of people who are different than us, and sometimes we forget and we mess up, or whether it's noticing some leftover childhood bias is popping up when we meet somebody new or someone that's challenges, whether it's our idea of gender or our idea of, you know, how we're supposed to be in community or how men and women are to be relating to each other, wherever it is, those biases will pop up and we can be horrified by our own thoughts, you know, and that it's not that we don't want to question our own thoughts. I just am inviting us to do it with tenderness.
Wow. I mean, there's so much that resonates about what you just said. And even just that sense of permitting ourselves to be horrified by our own thoughts is actually such a powerful mark of development. And even, I guess, of sovereignty itself, to be able to say, if we're taking it back to that vision of sovereignty coming from being the land herself was a goddess, and in the land was sovereign, and she was a sovereign figure. So then by extension, we then look to ourselves potentially as a queendom, you know, and that is a vast, vast territory. It full of blessed, enlightened, compassionate, perfect thought, and then also horrifying, imperfect, unboundaried, just foolish, but not in the sense necessarily of the sacred holy fools of the first card in the tarot, but more in that sense of the person who is blind and unable to welcome in the new and changing data. You know, it resonates so much to what you're saying in terms of, you know, having had a vision at one point of, if everyone could do spirit this way, then wouldn't we be grand? I remember having the vision of being a very proud third wave feminist right around the turn of the millennium, thinking if everybody did feminism just like us, the world would be so good. And then lo and behold, what do we learn over the two decades following? Where's intersectionality, and how do we start to understand the damages that white feminism has done, as well as the good? Because as in all, so many of these bold human endeavors, when we dare to reach outside of ourselves and seek change in the world, there is both beauty and enlightenment, and there is also the absolute inability to see and perceive that which we're not ready to really encounter, we haven't been prepared to yet come in relationship with.
Yeah, and it's around the corner. We haven't made it there, you know. In my work, I talk about seven different queendoms that reside within us that loosely track to the chakra system, for people who are familiar with that Eastern philosophy. And those queens sit in the center of that model, yet on each side, there are seven shadow queens. Mm. One that comes from a lack of that particular sovereignty, whether it's mental sovereignty or emotional sovereignty or energetic sovereignty, if we don't have enough of it, that shows up in one shadow version. Or if we are overexpressed and utilizing it too far, we've gone out of balance in that direction. There's a whole other set of behaviors, thoughts, experiences that creates. And so this work of being willing to develop the self, and then to recognize the betterment of the self, then gets to be an authentic relating with community, we have to look at these shadowy aspects and eventually come to see, oh, that's not who I am. These are thoughts that I have. These are behaviors that I've been habituated to utilize. These are conditions and conditioning that I was sort of drawn into in order to survive my early life experiences. And now, as I become older and more queenly and more sovereign, it's my job to look at these ways of being that I've had, or these choices that I've made, or these thoughts that are not me, they're just thoughts I'm having, and to begin to make decisions about, is that actually working for me anymore? Are there better ways that I can be connected to myself and connected to others and have good boundaries around self and other? Are there better ways to do it than the ways I was shown, or the ways I developed on my own, or the ways the world demands. Mm-hmm. And that brings us right back to that question of sovereignty again, that those kinds of questions that bring us into a deep knowledge of self are saying that I have the right as a sovereign being to ask these questions, right, and to renegotiate with myself as to who it is I have come here to be.
Mm. Oh, gorgeous. I love that set of seven queens and seven shadow queens. That's amazing. Maybe in the spirit of that, I'm curious if you have any, whether specific queens out of mythology or specific mythological beings who have helped to guide your work. What is the archetypal, and then where did the individual, like mythic characters, come in for you?
Oh, that's such a beautiful invitation. For me, this sort of started in this recognition of the mythic nature of life itself, that when we're so in the weeds that the particulars of our personality and our life experience seems just gigantic, that's all we can see. Mm-hmm. We miss that the living of any one life is actually growing the entirety of life itself, like life as a consciousness. Mm-hmm. This is a participatory universe. So it's mythic in that sense that you're not just growing for you, you're growing for all of us. And all the growth that you make for yourself, you make for everyone here. Mm-hmm. And in that way, it led me, very similar to you, out of my Catholic upbringing, I found the goddess culture. Mm-hmm. I found, and the one that began to resonate with me the most was my work with Isis, actually, and the Egyptian lineage, which was very, very powerful for me. And then from there, I found my way into working with the Magdalene, which I have a deep relationship with now through the ancient art of anointing, as I'm ordained in the Rosa Mystica lineage of sacred art of anointing. And then from there, it's just grown. Like now I'm exploring more of the Greek goddesses and coming to understand that Greece, in the period where it was really flourishing, was the prototype for self-development work. And their whole, I never really understood it. It just seemed like why they had all these kind of gods that were always running around doing funny things. But what was the actual religion, you know? Well, the religion was self-development, and it was the purpose of becoming the best version of oneself, whether that was a great athlete or a great orator or a great poet or a great actor, as a way of pleasing, because it would become pleasing to the gods, this idea that the perfected human. And so when I look at out there into the stories, it comes to me usually through that doorway of what we venerated, what we held up as beautiful and worth aspiring to, whether that was Isis and her incredible power as Great Mother to bring this new generation of divinity into the world through her connection with Osiris and the birth of Horus. We see that whole exact configuration repeated in Mother Mary and the birth of Jesus or Yeshua and then Magdalene. And I remember as a Catholic seeing that for the first time, and what? There's other virgin births? Like there's multiple virgin births? Like this is actually a thing. It's a cultural thing. That, and that's when it went from a personal story to me into the mythic understanding and the universal perspective. And it was like, oh, okay, there's something much bigger going on here than just this, you know, idea of just believe what we tell you to believe and everything will be okay. I had to go on my own journey after that. And to me, that's what really this is all about, this work of why stories are so important, because they call us onto a journey.
Yes. We have those moments of saying, wait a minute, we're part of this much bigger story. And it becomes like these kind of groundswells of, you know, intertextuality might be the modern term for it, in terms of the fact that these human stories have repeated. And to, you know, go back to that sense of, as you say, what is it for us to be living more mythic lives rather than being caught up in that minutia of, you know, go to work, come home, make dinner, pay taxes, and move on. Like there's something so much bigger at play.
And I I think for women in particular, there's an important reclamation that happens when we can see, oh, there's this lineage that harkens back to a time when the feminine as a quality, as an archetypal energy, was held differently than it's being held today. And then the way that that then reflects on us, you know, we've heard and seen representation matters. You know, this is why it's important to have advertising that includes people of all body types and all genders and expressions and all racial expressions, because representation matters. And in my own development, when I was able to connect with the sacred lineage of feminine queens and goddesses and the feminine face of the divine, something deeply shifted within me in terms of my own seeing of myself and my own holding of myself as someone who happened to have been born inside of a female body. And that work, you know, you're talking about feminism, that work is continuing on, that we are remembering, really, really literally remembering what it is that we are and that we hold.
Oh, Rima, I love the way that you weave so many of the ancient and the modern and the experiences together across time. And I know that's part of what you're going to be doing in your upcoming project, because I know you have a summit coming up. I'm excited to be part of it myself. Can you tell us a bit more about what you're expecting to create in this?
Absolutely. And I'm so thrilled that you are joining us for this fun adventure. It's called Sovereignty Rising. And it really is all about this idea of how we take what is a very, can be nebulous term of what exactly is sovereignty, and begin to think about the impact of it, what it means in our own lives, all the things we've been talking about, everything from reclaiming lost lineages and picking up these historical understandings of the power of the feminine, to this idea of what does this mean in my own life with how I'm raising my own children, or how I'm not choosing to raise children or have children, my gender expression or my relationship with my partner, whatever that might be. All of that gets to come forward. And I've actually identified five different tracks that I'm working in now, which are this idea of self-embodiment and being able to self-regulate as a key, really key component and a beginning place for all of sovereignty, is that that's, I've got to be able to be in self-regulation. Then there's the self-empowerment piece, which is, you know, part of that expression. What do I do with my self-regulation? How do I express out in the world? And then there's this idea of being in the self-awareness about how I am in partnership and relationship with others. And then ultimately in self-expression, which is my service work in the world. So how do I operate as a soul-sourced entrepreneur, or how do I be a stand for sovereignty inside of my corporate job, if that's what it is, or inside my home, if that's what it is. And so I have been so excited to gather powerful cohort of women who are interested in being in these conversations about what sovereignty looks like across these domains.
Oh, well, I am so excited to be a part of it. I'm so excited you're hosting these conversations. It's the sense of we need it now more than ever in the definition, the redefinition, the freedom from definition, but also that really careful tending and holding of saying that even in the midst of all the chaos of personal life, collective life, what's possible, what doesn't seem as possible, we can both be held by sort of those straight lines that you're offering in terms of here's categories, but within them, there's so many spirals and possibilities and different ways of being. So we'll include how folks can be involved and how they can follow you in the show notes. Are there any last thoughts before we say farewell today?
I think I would just like to end with something that's become so important for me. And it's this idea that it's an act of rebellion at the highest order to choose to continue your own path of growth, despite the heartbreak that comes from witnessing the suffering that's present in the world, and to remember that your own self-development is a gift to the world. And so I've made that very explicit in my own practices. When I sit down to do my morning prayers and meditation, I always claim and state and evoke and intend that my work is for the benefit of all beings, and may all beings be free. And so as we see what's happening in the world, sometimes it can be really hard to say, we know it's true. Oh, I've got high class problems, you know. And your willingness to face whatever are the dilemmas of your life full on and meet yourself inside of that facing cuts the trail for others and heals the spiral for all of us to walk it more fully and more completely. So if you feel called to come deeper into this conversation, I invite you to check out the summit. It's free and available to all who are interested.
Beautiful. Well, Rima, thank you so much for your time, for your insight, for all that you're weaving. And I look forward to speaking with you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Not Work Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. And do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marisagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.